the Sky News Centre at 5. Four members of a police helicopter crew have been cleared of misconduct after naked people were recorded from the air using a high-power camera. A fifth officer admitted filming members of the public as far back as 2007 and will be sentenced on Tuesday. In one case, a couple sitting naked outside a caravan were victims. One of those found not guilty, PC Matthew Lucas, spoke as he left Sheffield Crown Court.
It's been very difficult for the last 2 years, naturally, but it's all over now. We're going to get on with our lives.
Back to work? Like
that's a decision that we'll have to see about that, hopefully. Yes, yes. But a lot to happen before that, lots of celebration.
The Irish Prime Minister's described Brexit negotiations as the challenge of this generation. Leo Varadkar's warned time is running out, says he doesn't want to see the return of a hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic. There's to be an official crackdown on information being leaked from the White House and US security services to the media. Attorney General Jeff Sessions says he'll implement new procedures to try to catch those responsible. A plane crash at a Swiss summer camp killed two teenagers and a pilot. A third teenager seriously injured after the accident in the canton of Graubünden. Paris Saint-Germain president Nasser Al-Khelaifi insists they've broken no financial fair play rules by bringing in Neymar from Barcelona. The Brazil forwards joined for £200 million, which is more than double the previous transfer world record. He's also reported to be on wages of over £500,000 a week after tax. But Al-Khelaifi says they're abiding by UEFA regulations.
I have a very strong team with me, working really day and night, just applying, you know, with the regulation of financial play. So whoever thinking about financial play, I tell them, please, go have coffee and don't worry about us. We are in good hands.
And Camelot says it's now had a claim for last Friday's Euro Millions jackpot, a whopping £51.7 million. That's the latest. I'm Jo Flegg.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping us review this week's news is Charlotte Leslie's replacement. That's Labour MP for Bristol North West, Jaron Jones. After the 6 o'clock news, who and what is John Kelly, the US Army General, now Trump's Chief of Staff? Are there any Trump supporters left in the White House? And Amnesty brings out a shocking report about Iran's courts jailing human rights campaigners. And meanwhile, after being elected on a pro-Russia ticket, Trump has sheepishly signed into law new sanctions, ramping up economic war on Russia. We hear from former US Senate Foreign Policy Advisor James Jatras. Why the Cold War is back, the only question being how long until it goes hot. And as part of our series in the run-up to the 16th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks next month, we hear this week from the author of yet another book on 9/11 you won't find in Waterstones. He's William Stewart, and his book's entitled 9/11 to Armageddon, Bankers Plan Wars. It came out around the same time as airline pilot James Marshall's book, The Big Bamboozle, back in 2012. And held over from last week, author E. Michael Jones on the US Black Jewish Alliance breaking up around the same time as the 1967 Six-Day War, where Israeli army took over what was still known today as the Occupied Territories. Plus Martin Summers' chance, if he can fit it in, to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, dry and mild, temperatures around about 20 degrees Celsius this weekend, sunny periods and showers tomorrow, brightening up for a clear sunny day on Sunday. Next week, showery all week, with maybe some sun on Tuesday and Wednesday, just a little bit though, but otherwise cloudy all week with showers. Next weekend is the 12th and 13th of August, temperatures warm, and sunny weekend with some cloud, hopefully a rain-free week from Saturday on. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is Labour MP for Bristol North West, Darren Jones. Hi, Darren. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi there. Good to be with you.
Tell us a bit about yourself, first of all. What got you interested in politics?
Ah, good question. Well, I was always pretty opinionated growing up. So I was a kid in the 1980s on the Long Cross estate in Lawrence Weston. And so I was always quite opinionated as a kid about housing and public services and the fact that my mum and dad worked really hard but never really had enough money to pay for stuff. So I was political with the small p until I got to university and then got involved in party politics with the Labour Party.
So where did you study and what did you study?
So I was a human bioscientist at a university in Plymouth. And then I graduated from that and went on to law school, and my job before I was an MP was as a telecoms lawyer.
So why Labour? What are the other parties? Say Greens, for example.
Well, the Labour Party just seemed like the natural home for me when I was getting involved in party politics. My family aren't political at all, so there was kind of no history of my family involved in leafleting or election campaigns. So I kind of came with a bit of a blank slate, but my values are very much the Labour Party values, and the things I cared about were about social justice and tackling poverty and fairness and equality. And so there was no other home for me, really.
So are you talking about housing? In what way did that float your boat?
So I grew up in a council flat in Lawrence Weston in the 80s, as I say. One of the things that I first kicked off about was the fact we had some damp in my bedroom, which caused me to get asthma. It took a while to get the council to fix it, so that was like one issue. And actually my first political campaign was against the Labour Party when they were running the council and trying to close my sixth form at Portway School. And so kind of buildings and local authority funding and how we should be funding education and housing, so that regardless of how much money you have or where you come from, has been a constant theme for me from a very young age.
And what was it like growing up in Lawrence Weston?
I had a great childhood. I really enjoyed where I grew up. The great thing with growing up in a block of flats is you've got friends like next door and on the second floor and third floor, which you don't have necessarily if you're in a house where you don't know your neighbours. There's a great working class community in Lawrence Weston that I'm really proud of and still really proud of. It was challenging times. The days before Labour introduced the national minimum wage, my mum and dad earning a couple of quid an hour, having to choose between food and fuel and all of those types of problems that people that grew up in the 80s and early 90s experienced was something that I saw firsthand. But ultimately, I was in a loving family. I had great friends and I enjoyed growing up there.
Now, quite a lot of the MPs we have in here I would describe as a bit jaded, having been MPs for a long time. Now, you've only been there for a couple of months now. Just tell us what the experience has been like for you. What stood out suddenly finding yourself in Parliament?
The first thing is it's a really odd place to work. It's not like anywhere else. And talking about being jaded, I was actually quite disappointed in the first couple of weeks of being there because, having finally got to the House of Commons, which is something that I've wanted to do for a while to achieve the type of change that I'm talking about. And with this big issue of Brexit on the horizon, which I think is a defining issue for the future of our country. And I, get to stand up and I get to ask questions of the Prime Minister and the Secretary of State for leaving the EU and the Foreign Secretary. And I say to them, how are you going to protect my constituents' jobs with these negotiations, which aren't going very well? And they stand up and say, don't worry, we're a great nation, it's going to be fine. And you're like, come on guys, it has to be a bit better than that. So I'm hoping that my initial disappointment will wade when we go back after the summer recess.
So have you found it easy to keep up with the news? I mean, obviously somebody who's interested before you became an MP and trying to keep up with events since you became an MP?
It's actually harder. I mean, I've said that I think I knew more that was happening in the news when I wasn't an MP than when I am an MP, and that's largely because when you're an MP, your diary is so crazy all of the time that you're kind of going in and out of meetings, back-to-back meetings, travelling between events and meeting different organisations. You don't actually get to stop to look at what's happening around you. So I rely on like a media briefing in the morning, and when I finally get home at night, I tend to try and catch up on the news.
What about what news outlets do you trust? Because there's all this talk these days of fake news. I mean, I think the mainstream media are just as guilty as that as everyone else, pointing particularly towards things like weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. But whereabouts do you trust to get your news from?
Do you know, it's a really interesting question. So I was at an event last night with some doctoral researchers from Bristol University. They were hosting an event in my constituency about a piece of software they developed that detects fake news. And they look at facts and how that corroborates with headlines and inferences that are made. And on their study, they said that 86% of the news stories in their sample, which included the BBC, the Telegraph, and all these other types of product outfits, was making incorrect inferences and therefore could arguably be untrue. So who knows? I mean, I'm a scientist and a lawyer, so I like to base my understanding on facts and evidence where at all possible.
Well, look, let's start with something a little bit more down to earth, which is housing. And it's not often that I sing the praises of the mainstream press, but this week on Channel 4 News on Tuesday evening, Jackie Long, the social affairs editor, did, an excellent piece. Actually, Michael Crick did a really good piece as well on the background to how social housing was accelerated after World War II and how it ground to a halt in the 1980s under Margaret Thatcher. And so I thought we'd have a listen now, because it was somebody I was trying to get on the Friday after the Grenfell Tower here, but who was too busy, I saw pop up this week on Channel 4 News, and that's Anna Minton. She's the author of a book called Ground Control. She came to give us a talk in Bristol last year, in fact, on Stokes Croft somewhere, all about her book, which is all about, I suppose it's to do with gentrification, it's to do with social cleansing. But anyway, I just thought we'd have a listen to that now. It's about 5 minutes long, but it's well worth listening to, and I think we'll have a discussion with Martin Summers too, and you, Darren, about what you make of their trying to pull apart the sorts of changes we've had in this country that led to this appalling mismanagement of this tower block in Kensington and Chelsea.
You only need to look around the London skyline, and there's construction going up all over London. We are building lots and lots of homes, but who are they for? You know, they're for billionaire investors, they're for offshore investors, they're not for Londoners, and they're certainly not affordable. And even the 25% affordable housing, which is included in those developments, that was actually redefined by the Conservatives to mean up to 80% of market value or market rent. So when you look at a two-bedroom apartment on one of these new developments, say Elephant Park, which replaced the Haygate Estate in Elephant and Castle, that'll be between £750,000 to £1 million. The affordable component there is actually 80% of that. How is that affordable? The whole first phase of Elephant Park has been sold to foreign investors, and there is actually a huge amount of that sort of thing going on, of flipping, where apartments are sold directly to Southeast Asia investor markets without even hitting London.
What you're missing, if I can say, is actually when you do sell to an overseas investor, there's still the Section 106 money, as you well know, and that goes to affordable housing. So if you build housing for all sorts of people, which is 80% of market rent.
Can I just bring in Kate McIntosh really quickly? Because you're an architect who started your career with a very great vision in the 60s for good quality social housing that wasn't supposed to be the experience of people like Ilhan.
I'd like to remind everybody that Britain is the fifth richest country in the world. I think it's totally disgusting that with the withdrawal and reduction in the assistance for rents, which is money which is all being moved from the public sector to the private sector, that it's predicted that 300,000 children will be evicted across this country. In other countries, they have a different priority. They realise that the future of their country and the standing of their nation depends on the next generation. In Norway, they have a ministry for housing, and all policies which are proposed have to be passed by this ministry for housing as to what the effects on children will be. The fact that rough sleepers, for instance, the number of rough sleepers has virtually doubled in 6 years.
There is a real issue, isn't there, about developers promising social housing, affordable homes, and then going back on that promise right at the last minute. That is an issue, isn't it?
Well, the market has to be able to work, and if the market works by actually making sure that we sell as many houses as possible, then you'll get more social housing built. If you just have a centralised plan system, you won't build anything.
The market totally doesn't work.
£3 billion in London, Mr. Khan's got the money to build.
Has never built the amount of housing that we need.
The GLA is committed to build housing.
The private sector has built about the same same amount of housing every year since the Second World War. It hasn't changed.
It's gone up
What's
and down, actually.
Well, roughly about 150,000 homes a year. Hasn't really changed. What has changed is we're no longer building any public housing and hardly any housing association housing. Westminster Council's policy, I'm afraid, is that for people in social housing who are not in priority need, the policy is to actually send them to other cities. That is now the council's official policy.
That is a myth, actually. We're not sending lots of people anywhere else.
That's in the planning document.
Things are in documents, whether they actually happen or not.
They are happening.
In Germany, they only allow the increase of rent in line with inflation, and they insist that the minimum tenancy must be for at least 3 years. Mm. So that, in consequence, the amount of public money which goes to subsidise the private sector in Germany is virtually flatlining, whereas in this country...
And so is housing inflation.
What about the land value tax? Why do you think that would be helpful?
Well, I mean, the planning system was designed with a land value tax built in it. Lots of European countries have it. They even have it in America, Australia, Hong Kong. You know, not exactly bastions of socialism. It's a way of damping down this out-of-control, speculative casino market. That's why we've got this housing crisis, because the market is totally dysfunctional. So market answers can never be the solution.
Now, in Cardiff, I understand, they have suspended the right to buy. Isn't that one way of making sure that the stock remains as buoyant as possible?
We've done that in Scotland and in Wales, and I wouldn't support that, because the public want the right to buy. That's why Mrs. Thatcher won all those elections. It's that simple.
So
you can't keep telling the public.
Well,
can't tell
very long.
I don't believe
of those right to buy properties are now owned by private landlords, professional private landlords who rent them out at 3 and 4 times the price.
And lots of people from low incomes got onto the housing ladder because of that. It's very good for middle class property people in London to say that, but the reality is people got on the market for the first time. I know from working class backgrounds.
That perhaps wasn't a bad thing.
In Scotland, they have built in the last 10 years as much social housing as the whole of the rest of UK put together. And the average Scot now has more disposable income than the average throughout the rest of UK, precisely because the cost of housing as a proportion of income is much lower.
So that was a clip from Channel 4 News on Tuesday. You heard the social affairs editor Jackie Long there talking to Anna Minton. She's the author of Ground Control, and also to Tory member of the London Assembly for West Central, Tony Devenish, and architect Kate McIntosh.
I mean, I just don't even understand the point that Tony was making in that clip. I mean,
well, he's talking about market forces, isn't he? He says that you've got to have a market. Market forces have got to be allowed to operate, and as soon as the government intervenes, then you're stopping the market.
Oh, well, this is nonsense. I mean, this is what Thatcher wanted to do. She wanted to privatise the housing sector, to turn it into a market. And now I have probably hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people in my constituency who are waiting for a council house. People on the wait. There's 14,000 people on the waiting list in Bristol some time ago, and then there's so many more stuck in really low quality housing in the private rented sector, and they're charging them far too much money to live there.
So where are shop doorways and tents on the housing market? Whereabouts do they fit in?
Well, exactly. They shouldn't be there. We should have a baseline of council housing with proper rents that people can afford, that gives people the dignity of a warm, secure home for them to live in and to raise their families in. I mean, fine, you know, people that want to be able to buy their home should have access to that. People that want to save equity in their homes, that's fine too. I'm not saying we should, like, renationalise the entire kind of housing model, but we need that baseline of council housing, and we need to take tougher action on landlords that aren't acting in the right way too.
Sounds like a lot of building needs to happen, Martin Summers. What about the figure there we heard, 300,000 children now set to be evicted?
Well, I mean, we're reaping the whirlwind of a whole generation of failed policy, and I have to say this, Darren, there were 13 years of Labour government and very little was done. And we're now in a real cul-de-sac here. I mean, it's just in a free market society where you have differential wages, the bottom third of the population are never going to earn enough to be able to afford decent accommodation. Tory governments used to understand that in the 1950s when Harold Macmillan told the working class they'd never had it so good. That was because he'd built the most council houses of any prime minister, and he was a Tory. And what's happened with the whole idea that selling off council housing was popular, it was popular, wasn't very popular to begin with. People had to be pushed into doing it. But of course, people bought at much less than the market price for their houses. So effectively, what the government was doing is taking taxpayers' money and buying votes with it. And if you remember, Tony, we had the only UKIP councillor in Bristol on this show some months ago, years ago now, and he admitted that in actual fact he'd made nearly £250,000 out of that in terms of capital gains. Now, of course he's going to vote Conservative. He's just been given £250,000 by the government. But there's no fairness in that, and it's a political decision to try and buy votes in certain constituencies. And of course, he's saying Margaret Thatcher won all these elections. Well, she never got 50% of the vote. What she did was she gerrymandered and used public money to buy elections, and that's why we've got ourselves into a mess.
Well, there's also something very worrying, Martin, about the possibility that people may be being shipped out, particularly Labour voters. We've seen in Kensington and Chelsea, a very marginal constituency, because they're not seen to be in dire social need. They're being shipped out of social housing, out of the city, into other cities.
Well, they are. I mean, of course, at one stage they're talking about changing the constituency boundaries as well. This is all very typical of the way they operate, but I think the Labour majority in Kensington Chelsea was wiped out in the Grenfell fire. Of course, probably if there was an election tomorrow, the Labour would probably win.
Okay, Darren, how do we fix it?
We need government to allow councils to borrow and build proper council housing that can be done at proper affordable rents outside of this hyping up of the market that's led to high rent, which of course is increasing the housing cost for government when they're providing housing benefits to people that need it as well. The market is out of control on housing, and government needs to intervene to inject some fairness into it, and that requires national government to do that.
Any hope of that?
Well, I'll be fighting for it, and I know that lots of people on the Labour benches will be fighting for it. The only way we can achieve it is by being in government, and that depends on the next general election.
On another subject, Sunday evening, they've been plugging it on Channel 4 for the last couple of weeks. It'll be an interesting programme about Princess Diana. It was shown, I think, probably 10 years ago in the US on NBC. These tapes recorded with voice coach Mr. Settlin, and then smuggled out to Andrew Morton, and he used them to write his book Diana, Her True Story, which was really an expose of what was a loveless marriage and a horrific situation for Diana back in the early 1990s. Do you think this is something that's is it there's any kind of interest in still, Darren? Because it's a long time ago now, isn't it?
I mean, it's a good question. I mean, I don't know. People seem to be interested in it. I mean, it's being reported in the media. I mean, when you talk about it being a long time ago, I mean, I was, you know, born in 1986, and one of the first kind of major pieces of news I remember, other than Labour's landslide election in 97, was actually the death of Princess Diana. I remember going down, we'd just moved into a council house because my younger sister had been born, so I went downstairs to turn on the old black box where you had the cable TV, I think it was cable and wireless, right, and to try and put it on the Nickelodeon channel, and in fact the news came up from the night before, and I remember seeing the news that Princess Diana had died. So for me, it feels like a long time ago. What it achieves by sharing this, I don't know, but it's not for me to say whether it should or shouldn't be aired. That's up to media broadcasters and the public.
Martin, it's been quite a few establishment voices saying no, this is terrible, it shouldn't happen. Channel 4 have fought it, possibly even potentially, you know, fighting a legal battle if necessary to keep it on the air. But notably, William and Harry haven't said anything about it, have they? They certainly haven't raised their voice and said we don't want our mother to be heard.
Well, there clearly is some interest in this, the ongoing, and as Darren says, it's for the media companies concerned and for the public. The pop star Brian Eno talks about proper gender, and what he means by that is the things that people are told to worry about. So, for example, we're told to worry about the evil government of Syria and the evil things it does, but not the evil government in Saudi Arabia and what it does in Yemen. And one thing is we're bombarded with, the other thing is ignored. And this is the way the mainstream media works. It's not so much that it distorts, although it does. It also creates what people worry about. the things that they care about. But I'm afraid, you know, somebody like Diana with a massive charisma and sort of huge interest in her. I was living in Poland when that happened, and even the Poles were fascinated because she was just, you know, a media character.
Also, all over the BBC, there's been talk about an interview that they're about to air with Tony Blair. And I know you're a bit of a fan, aren't you, Darren? I saw in the Bristol Post, Bristol's newest MP, Darren Jones, says Tony Blair is his political hero on BBC Five Live. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, so this was Pinar's politics show on Sunday mornings.
Oh yes, Pinar. Yes.
Pinar. Yeah, yeah. Which I have to be honest, I'd never listened to before. I didn't really know what it was, and I kind of turned up because they said, you know, come in for 10 minutes. It was actually my first official day off since my election, so I had to kind of persuade my wife to come and join me to take part in that as part of our kind of day out in London on that day. And there were these kind of quick fire questions with like Weakest Link music in the background, and I hadn't prepared for anything really. And it was snog, marry, avoid, have you broken the law, who's your inspiration now? And then this question came up that said, you know, of MPs of all time, who's inspired you? Now, I should probably have a much better answer steeped in history, but
you
was...
Okay, I'm going to give you a little bit of consideration time.
Sure.
If you had your time again, would it still be Tony Blair? If not, who?
Well, the point I was making on that show was that the person that inspired me into party politics was Tony Blair in the 1997 general election. As I said earlier, you know, as a kid growing up, I was in Shirehampton then, as opposed to in Lawrence Weston. But for the first time, I saw politics as a vehicle through which we can achieve change. And what Tony Blair personified with Labour in government at that stage was something that got me interested in that. And I know people in Bristol who are members of Momentum who were inspired into politics because of Tony Blair. So, I mean, I wouldn't say he was my all-time hero. I was just saying that he was the person that inspired me to get involved in party politics.
Okay, so who's the, if it's not Blair, who is it?
Oh, I'm not going to answer that. I haven't done my research.
Oh,
I mean, look,
okay.
I'm not someone that emotionally gets inspired by people. I'm someone that wants to try and achieve change for my constituents, and I'm just going to carry on doing that.
What about when you first were declared an MP, you said that you were surprised that you didn't expect to win. Is that true as well?
Yeah, it is. I mean, yeah, it was. I mean, I was the candidate in Bristol Northwest at the 2015 general election. I was a candidate for 3 years, and we spent every weekend knocking on doors and spent a huge amount of money that we'd raised, and the polls were neck and neck at the time, and we were told we were going to win it, and it's a seat you've got to win to be in government, and we lost by 4,500 votes. Now, the polling for the Labour Party at the point that the general election was called was awful, and all of the history and evidence suggested that a seat like Bristol Northwest is only won by the candidate of the party that ends up in government. So, you know, no one thought that we would win Bristol North West. I was fighting it because it was my home, I care about it, and I thought there was a political argument to be made. But of course, I'm thrilled to be the MP for my home constituency. That's what I always wanted to do.
So what kind of Labour person are you? Because they've sort of settled out into the Owen Jones Labour and the Jeremy Corbyn Labour. So which side of the camp were you on?
I don't think it's about personalities. I like to see myself as a pragmatic. I said before the election that I didn't think we would win a general election with Jeremy, and I was evidently wrong. He did very well, and I'm honest enough to be able to say that, you know, I didn't expect that outcome, and that's what happened. But
so why didn't you think he was? I mean, the Labour Party membership is a vast membership.
Yeah.
Why didn't you think that he was the man for the job after they'd endorsed him?
Well, it was because of my received wisdom that you only end up in government if you win marginal seats like the one I'd lost not long before. And again, the wisdom is that you only win seats like mine if you persuade Tories to come and vote for you. Now, we persuaded Tories to come and vote for me in Bristol North West largely around the issue of Europe, but that's not denying the fact that Jeremy and the manifesto enthused a lot of the Labour base, including a lot of young people who came to vote. And so, you know, as I say, the received wisdom that I had before about how you win general elections maybe needs a bit of updating, and I've said that publicly.
Yeah, good. So I think there's a lot of this sort of focus group stuff that just simply doesn't actually work in reality. It seems to be just a way of bamboozling people. Anyhow, on to some local stuff now, and I'm giving a little bit of a plug for Dialect, which is back next Tuesday at noon, because we had a particularly good, I thought anyway, guest interviewed on there this week by the name of Mark Steeds. He's a publican up in Gloucestershire, and he's part of something called Bristol Radical History Group. He's written a book about the abolitionists of Bristol, one of the first published by the Radical History Group. And one of the things he came up with, I didn't realise that this was even happening, was that there is a bit of a campaign getting going and a possible fund starting to get a Bristol Radical History, Bristol Slavery Hub, kind of history hub on the Welsh back, with some of the local residents supporting it as well. So let's have a listen to Mark Steeds now.
There's some old dockside buildings that would be ripe for making a proper museum and sort of memorial, right next to Redcliffe Bridge, actually. They're the last buildings that haven't been sort of developed, if you like. They go back to 1883, and they'd be a perfect candidate if the council wanted to move away from its penchant for bars and restaurants.
Now, local people around Welshback aren't really happy about having more bars and restaurants either.
No, they're not, and they see that building as a history hub, and what perfect history than reconciliation of the slave trade.
Some would say, look, this was a horrible time in Bristol's history, best forgotten.
You can't forget it, no. And it would be wrong to forget it. It goes on to this day. I mean, and so many great Bristolians put their lives on the line for it.
Hang on a minute. The slave trade was abolished 200 years ago.
Well, the trade was abolished 200 years ago, but emancipation didn't come until 1833. 1834 got passed in Parliament, and in 1838 you finally got a cessation in slavery, as it were. But in order to circumvent that, the merchant venturers, again, if you like, they were shipping people over from the subcontinent, India, and from Hong Kong, coolie labour they were calling it, and they were supplanting the slaves who were now trying to work for money. They were supplanting them with indentured labourers, if you like, again coming from the subcontinent, as I say, and it'd gone 200 years and thousands of miles from indentured labourers from Britain going out to indentured servants coming in again, you know, and it was all the while is for these people to make money.
So that's Mark Steeds there from Bristol Radical History Group. Darren, what's your thoughts about this? Darren Jones, Bristol North West Labour MP, about whether you think Bristol is actually doing what it should be to remember this, because I mean, he was pointing out another part of that interview in Nantes in France. There's an enormous thing about slavery that happened there, which was a very similar kind of equivalent city to Bristol, and also in Liverpool.
Yeah, I mean, my personal view is that we should always be doing a bit. We should be doing more than we currently do on that in Bristol, because I mean, I don't think there's anything significant here that talks about our relationship with that in the past.
Well, there's a little bit, the corner of the M shed, but it doesn't mention, for example, doesn't mention the merchant venturers at all.
Sure, I mean, that's not good enough, and we need to, just for educative purposes more than anything, make sure that people understand that, you know, the lushness of Clifton came as a consequence of the actions of this city. And we should, you know, I think there was a debate about whether we should say sorry publicly in the past. Clearly people that are doing business and leading the city and being involved in it say didn't have anything to do with it, but we shouldn't shy away from that and just kind of remove it from the visible history of our city. One of the things that I'm very passionate about is the history of my constituency, which I think is fascinating. And one of the things that I will be doing, in fact, I've not said this publicly before, so here we are, hot off the press, is an exhibition about the history and culture of all the different communities in Bristol North West, because a lot of the history is focused on the centre of Bristol, but not necessarily in my part. And there's a lot that we need to raise about my constituency and its various communities. And if this is part of it, then I'm going to help raise that profile as part of that that conversation.
Mark Steeds, Martin, was talking about the Vikings and Saxon slavery going on in Bristol, and saying actually any proper history hub would be looking at it right up to today, economic slavery and wage slavery.
Well, I mean, I'm obviously in favour of this sort of thing in general, although you've got to be careful that people don't think you're just, creating a boondoggle. You know, how's it going to be funded, for example, is an issue that people are going to say, well, who paid for that, etc.
Setting up a fund, so...
Yes, OK, but I'm just saying that, you know, if we're cutting, vital social services in Bristol, as unfortunately we are, you've then got an issue about
is handing over two bits of Bristol City Council property, potentially, not about the council actually funding it, so that people can use it rather than that they're left derelict.
Well, I mean, in that case, I'm in favour of it, but, you know, you can understand that questions are going to be asked about that when we've got so many priorities.
What about economic slavery? Is that stretching a
point?
Well,
no, I think it's perfectly legitimate to widen the scope. because, I mean, there's a tendency to pat Britain on the back, we got rid of slavery, but in actual fact, of course, the economic exploitation of people didn't end then and hasn't ended now.
Yeah, and also, I mean, one of the points he makes is all of the things to remember Colston, Edward Colston, around the city, and very little to remember people who actually abolished the slave trade of all sorts over the years. And if you want to hear that full interview, it's next Tuesday at noon here on BCFM 93.2. Our next clip is actually another thing which is going to be on in the future. I just thought I had to do it because it was. I went down to talk to a chap called Mike Walker from the Bristol Omnibus Vehicle Collection down in Weston, with all these in this old bus garage in Weston on the old airfield, where they've got quite a lot of old Bristol buses sitting in there. And he owns and runs some of them in these kind of days out during the summer. But he was a bus conductor in Bristol for a while, and he was talking to me yesterday about the privatisation of the buses in the 1970s and 1980s, because Bristol's in Bristol Omnibus Company used to run the buses and actually sometimes turn a reasonable little profit for the city council.
All of the buses here, including this one which wasn't made in Bristol, did work in and around Bristol or the surrounding countryside, because Bristol Tramways and Carriage Company, as it was up until 57 and became Bristol Omnibus Company and is now, of course, First, ran as far north as Gloucester and Cheltenham and as far south or west as Bridgewater. And on the left here, we have a 1955 double-decker. The way Bristol Omnibus Company ran, or Bristol Tramways ran in the city of Bristol, was through a separate organisation, and they shared the operation with the Bristol City Council. It's called Bristol Joint Services. There was a 50% ownership by both of them. The Bristol Tramways provided the management and looked after the organisation, but they shared any profits or any losses. This was a Bristol Joint Services bus.
Was it profitable, or were they losing money?
Oh, it was profitable for a while, and then it started to lose money. And in fact, the joint services arrangement was disbanded in 1978 because there was discussions, shall we say, between the politicians in the city council and the people who then run the buses in Bristol Omnibus, who wanted to put the fares up more and more to try and recoup revenue that was being lost, and the city council didn't want that, so there was a parting of the way.
An interesting situation now with First, because they've just again and again put their fares up.
There is no say. First is a purely commercial operation in Bristol now. Up until 1986 and the 1985 Transport Act, which was ended up with bus deregulation, the bus operator would have needed a licence to run his routes, and up until the 1980s would have in fact needed to go before a public inquiry to put fares up, and would have got a lot of objections, obviously, and that became more and more difficult for the operator. That's not the case now. The operator sets his own fares.
That's Mike Walker from the Bristol Omnibus Vehicle Collection. And you will be able to see some of those buses, open doors day in September. But also, it does rather remind me, Darren, of what happened with the railways, because there was such a strict regime over being the companies or the government, as it was running it, and the local city council, the Bristol Omnibus Company, being not allowed to put the fares up, that they ended up starting to lose money, and there's nothing they can do about it. It's exactly what happened with the railways in the run-up to the beaching era in the 1960s.
Well, of course, with the beaching report and the closure of inner-city rail stations, we're now trying to unwind that. So something that I'm carrying on campaigning for that my predecessor started was about the Henbury Loop Line and the opening of stations in the north part of my constituency, because for many people, if you don't have access to a car, and of course, you know, we're trying to encourage people not to use cars, especially if they're coming into the centre of Bristol, there's just no reliable public service network for them. The buses are too expensive. Lots of the routes in my constituency are subsidised by the local authority, who are having to cut the subsidy routes, and therefore there are routes that are being closed. And basically, it's a disaster for people who either want to use public transport or rely on it because you're an older person. If you're a younger person and you want to go to college, and you'd need to go to Filton, to the South Gloucester College, or to into town for Bristol City College, then actually the bus fare is really expensive for lots of people to get there every day. It just doesn't work economically for people, which is why I've always supported a municipal-owned bus company. I'd like Bristol City Council to have its own bus company to compete with First and others, to try and generate profit at a time when central government funds are being cut, and to intersect and work properly with a fully functioning inner-city rail network as well.
Then were the days, eh, Martin, when you had to have a public inquiry if you wanted to put the fares up?
Well, I think we were talking about council housing earlier and, of course, publicly run transport systems. I'm old enough to remember when these things were still functioning. And what we did in the 1980s was common sense was thrown out of the window. And then in the 1990s and the 2000s, during Tory and Labour governments, there was the idea that there's a ratchet to this. You know, once we've got rid of it, we can't bring it back. But I think ultimately, if something's stupid and wrong, ultimately you've got to go and places like Stockholm or Seattle look at us and think, well, why are you running it like that? This doesn't work.
Well, oligopolies and monopolies were what led to the English Civil War.
Well, this oligopoly and monopoly is what led to nationalisation, because, of course, originally the original bus companies running Bristol and the tram companies were privately run, but they were taken over after the Second World War and there was a plan as well. When you say having competition between the municipal bus company and other people, I mean, in actual fact, there was a plan. We don't want competition. And people say, well, no competition? Yes, because it's a monopoly. And in actual fact, some things are natural monopolies. You know, you can't have, like, the privatisation of the railways, you know. Who can say that having lots of different companies who don't really compete with each other is a competition? It isn't. I've got a degree in economics. This isn't a competition.
Darren, what do you make of the energy market? There's been a lot of talk about that recently, and we've also had British Gas just whacking up their retail prices, even though the wholesale price of gas is dropping.
Yeah, I mean, this is the problem with all of these kind of utilities, not just gas and electricity and water, but the utility of transport as well. And that, you know, if there's only one pipe or one cable or one track, then actually how do you have effective competition on those? And ultimately, you know, the British Gas example, there is detriment to consumers. And the government said in the general election campaign that they were going to take steps to prevent these hikes in prices and to do energy tariff reform. And they just seem to have dropped that. And so it's something that I'm going to be raising when we get back to Parliament after the summer.
MP, effectively now you're impotent. You can't do anything about it. It's actually up to the privatised electricity companies to set whatever price they want.
Well, there's two things. I mean, firstly, MP doesn't have a magic wand, but what they can do is meet people and get press coverage and work with constituents to pressure companies to vote with their feet and to switch to other providers and all that sort of stuff.
But they work for their shareholders, don't they? Not for you.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. They're private companies. Of course they do. But also, if you have consumer power and consumers are empowered, then, you know, they're going to start losing money if people get a bad service and they shift. But the other half of what I can do, of course, is to pressure the government and to raise questions in the House and make speeches and campaign with others to be able to try and put pressure on the government to say what they were going to do and actually deliver it. But as I say, on with the housing issue, ultimately, it requires us to be in power. So, you know, there's stuff we can do now, but we also need to be campaigning to try and get us across the line with the majority government at the next election as well.
So nothing for another 5 years?
Well, I don't know when the next general election is going to be. I mean, hopefully, I get enough time to fundraise for the next leaflet because we spent everything last time. But, we're selecting our parliamentary candidates across the country in our marginal seats over the summer and early autumn. Organisations are being set up for those seats that we think we can win. So for me, you know, the neighbouring constituency to mine, Filton and Bradley Stoke, where there's Tory MP Jack Lopresti, is going to be a target seat for us. And, you know, my job, I imagine, will be not just holding on to my seat, but doing everything that I can to help whoever the candidate is there to help us get that seat at the election so that it contributes to our majority.
So we've got another 5 years of all these private industries running us ragged.
Well, I mean, it's politics, right? I mean, we can't, if the government's got the power and we're not in government, then, you know, that's why voting matters. That's why politics matters.
Another story this week, a sleeper agent, Royal Marine, who made bombs for Irish Republicans, had 300 government and military targets, as the police admit his arsenal of mines, mortars and drugs are still hidden in tunnels around the UK. The Royal Marine built bombs for the Continuity IRA at his grandmother's house, constructed 14 pipe bombs, 2 mines and could have built 19 more. The 31-year-old became the first Marine to be jailed for UK under UK terrorism offences. The judge jailed him for 18 years, telling him he had betrayed his fellow Marines, Martin.
Well, he's...
His name, by the way, Kieran Maxwell.
Yes, well, I mean, it's a very interesting case, this. I think he's obviously an incredibly talented soldier, in any which by any definition, apart from getting caught. And, of course, there's no political basis for what he's trying to do. The Irish Republican movement have committed wholeheartedly to a non-violent strategy, and of course he's not happy with that, and is obviously, you know, capable of actualising that. But I mean, it's very sad because he's not going to achieve anything, and he's now going to go to prison for years and years and years for no purpose.
Well, what do you think was the parallels possibly with the Operation Gladio we saw? Because he had a whole stash of stuff. It could be that these were he was actually infiltrated into the army. And there's also a comparison with Islam. If he had been a Muslim, for example, that had managed to get into the army and done all this, we would have been right around the world, headlines all over the place for weeks.
Well, I mean, you're putting together a lot of different things in one pot there. Gladio is a completely different setup. As you know, Gladio was a NATO-run terrorist operation in Italy in particular, Belgium and elsewhere. This guy was a continuity IRA operative who was infiltrated into the Marines. It doesn't look as if he was run by NATO intelligence at all. And I think you're misleading people if you suggest that that's the case.
Well, why does it not look like that?
Because what he looks like to me is a very committed Irish Republican. And of course there were the Force Research Unit, as you know, operating in Northern Ireland, was running all of the loyalist paramilitaries and a lot of what was going on inside the IRA. This guy doesn't fit into any of that. He's a continuity IRA activist who has joined the Marines in order to try and infiltrate. In fact, that's how he got hold of all the weaponry. I mean, of course, the Marines have then got to ask how was he able to get away with that for years?
Darren, 14 pipe bombs, 2 anti-personnel mines. I mean, the list is actually incredible. Nearly 400 rounds of ammunition, various magazines, detonating cord, power units to blow up bombs. And yet, actually, not as much coverage, I think, and detailed investigation of this case as if the guy had been a Muslim, for example.
I mean, it's interesting in that I hadn't actually heard of the case. I don't know if this goes back to my point about being so busy that I have to catch up on the news at like 11 p.m. at night, but I think your point probably has some validity to it, that, you know, if someone had done that much work to fuel potential terrorism and it was a radicalized Muslim, then actually I think you're probably right. The coverage would have been entirely different. I probably would have heard about it. This one I didn't hear anything about.
43 purpose-built woodland hides at 8 locations in Northern Ireland and England. Probably some still that haven't been discovered.
Can I just correct you on that? He actually gave information about various hides, which he didn't have to give, which is why the sentence was actually reduced from what it was. So, in other words, he cooperated with the investigation.
But there may be hides he still has.
Well, he may be hiding others. But the point is that the judge accepted that he had cooperated with the investigation and therefore gave him a relatively lenient sentence. But he's obviously a very dangerous character.
There is a broader point here as well as to how this could have happened in the first place. I mean, I'm hoping there's going to be an inquiry by the army or whoever it was that's in charge of these sites to check how someone can actually smuggle this stuff out in the first place, because it shouldn't be happening.
You would have thought they would keep an eye, Martin, on number one on ammunition and number two on high explosives and anti-personnel mines.
You would have thought so. And also, of course, there's a question of, was he vetted properly? I understand his family are not known for their Republican sympathies, but he is. But I have to say, having known many people of Republican political persuasion, none of them would support this because there isn't a political basis for an armed struggle.
So
it's over.
It does make you wonder what's going on then, doesn't it?
Well, it does, but I think you've got to recognise that and I've met people from Continuity IRA when I was in Belfast. They've got their views. And what the mainstream Republican movement would say about that is, you can have your views, you can oppose the peace process if you want to, that's fine, but we're not going to have people doing stuff which isn't authorised like this.
And none of the articles about him do I hear him described as a lone wolf, for example.
Well, he's not a lone wolf, he's a member of the Continuity IRA. But what the point of what provisional IRA activists would say, we're an army, and when we call a ceasefire, that means you put your guns down, otherwise we'll kill you.
Talking of the army could be needed in prisons, a former governor said this week. A former prison governor says the government should consider calling in the army to restore order in prisons. Speaking to BBC Newsnight, Ian Aitchison admitted the suggestion was radical and controversial, but said the risks of doing nothing are simply too high. Darren, we've seen over the last few weeks several reports, and now this week the chairman of the, I think it's the Prison Governors Association, speaking out to say that effectively our prisons are in meltdown.
Yeah, I mean, this is part of the austerity impact. You know, I've had meetings with the Police and Crime Commissioner and the Chief Constable on the policing side, and actually every day I seem to be having meetings of people who are buckling under the pressure of such severe and long cuts to public funding. You know, we can't deliver our services properly without the money to do it, and the government is making its decision, you know, when it could be raising corporation tax, for example, to fund these things properly. Now, from my perspective as a constituency MP, you know, Horfield Prison is just outside of my boundary, but it's pretty close, and I'll probably have constituents in there. And, you know, we've had reports about prisoners committing suicide and self-harming and drug use and all of these things that shouldn't be happening in a space like Horfield Prison or any other place. So, I mean, I'll be going down at some point, probably once I get back from my holidays in a couple of weeks, to see for myself what the impact is. And, you know, I hope we wouldn't get to a position where we're having to rely on the armed forces to come in and do the jobs of prisoners, of prison staff properly. What we need to do is get the government to fund our institutions and our staff properly to do the job right in the first place.
Also, a judge has warned of blood on her hands this week if a suicidal girl is forced out of secure care. Sir James Munby, head of the High Court's Family Division, said he was ashamed and embarrassed that no hospital place has been found for this 17-year-old who's believed to be suicidal. Martin, on the economic side, I mean, this austerity has been affecting so many things in society. Is there anything we can do to stop this sort of situation where somebody is just simply being let out of government security and then just left essentially to just go and kill themselves when they know that that's what she's likely to do?
All right, well, if we're talking about austerity, and what we're talking about is lack of resources, yeah, to do a proper
job. I mean,
we're hearing
about prisons in here as well.
Lack of resources to do a proper job. And as I said last week on the show, the coalition government lost the country's AAA credit rating.
Well, I think we know
within
the
first
we're in a few months. What I'm interested in is some light at the end of the tunnel, please.
Well, I'm just trying to explain to you the problem is cutting public expenditure or reducing the deficit by attempting to cut public expenditure is counterproductive, because in actual fact I interviewed Nick Clegg, if you remember, when he was first elected as Deputy Prime Minister. I said, your policy is going to lose the country's credit rating. He didn't understand the question, but soon thereafter
it was a very, very long question.
It was a long question because it was a complicated question, but he didn't understand the question and he flim-flammed, and in actual fact, as I predicted, they lost the country's credit rating because they tried to cut too far too fast, which was the point that Ed Balls made and who was of course ridiculed for. You can't cut the deficit by cutting public expenditure just by cutting public expenditure. We've got to rebuild the tax base. We were talking earlier about the 1950s and Macmillan saying you'd never had it so good. The top rate of tax in that era during the Korean War was 95%, 96% in the United States of America. Now, that's where the resources
have
gone.
The thing is, Martin, things are going worse. And if you have listened to the person that really runs Britain, would you like to have a guess who that is? His second name is Carnage. His first name is Mark. Anyway, he had something to say this week. And I do wonder sometimes whether actually the city is just totally in charge. If you remember, we had that clip from Justin Walker saying his uncle told him on a train, he said, look, actually, the Bank of England's really running things. His uncle was a former governor of the bank. Director of the Bank of England. Mm. And he said they controlled all politics, politicians, and they controlled all the media, so not to believe either. But anyway, let's have a listen now to what Mark Carney, is his proper name, had to say about the forecast for the future. A little clip from that, because it was just terminally dull. But I managed to find a
little bit. He's supposed to be dull, Tony, don't you realise?
Oh, but it's just, I mean,
if he was exciting, it would be worrying.
These people are running things scares me to death. Anyway, let's have a listen to this now.
As the Brexit negotiations proceed, the assumption of a smooth transition to a new economic relationship with the EU will be tested. If UK households and businesses look through the flurry of headlines, then the economy can be expected to pick up from its current period of sluggishness. Given the outlook for supply in the economy, even a limited pickup in growth is likely to have consequences for the stance of monetary policy. That's because, as the MPC has previously emphasized, the process of leaving the European Union is beginning to affect potential supply in the UK. Brexit-related uncertainties are causing some companies to delay decisions about building capacity and entering new markets. And the UK's eventual new trading arrangements will require a period of reallocation as some sectors of the economy expand and others contract. Moreover, prolonged low investment will restrain growth in the capital stock and increases in productivity. Indeed, if the MPC's current forecast comes to pass, the level of investment in 2020 is expected to be 20 percentage points below the level which the MPC had projected just before the referendum.
Well, he's basically speaking in code, and he's saying that Brexit is probably going to be a bit of a disaster, Tony, which is probably what you don't want to hear, but there, I can't put any bold the face on it.
Actually, I mean, we were predicting on this programme that it was an economic disaster before we even had a referendum. But anyway, Darren, what do you make? Is Brexit going to be responsible, or was an economic disaster going to happen anyway?
Well, Brexit is definitely going to be part of the problem. You know, we're going to be poorer as a country because of the consequences of that decision. And I think I was elected on a pro-European majority, not least to protect the thousands of jobs in my constituency linked with European trade, but to try and make the case for some sense in Parliament to protect the future of our country and our ability to actually pay for public services as well as everything else at the same time.
Now, I think you said you were involved, is it bioscience in your degree?
That was my undergraduate, yeah.
Right, because there's a story for you now.
Oh, okay.
This is a... sorry.
But
this is the first human genome being edited. And it's bringing us one step closer to consumer eugenics, says Dr. David King in The Guardian today. This is a bit of a concern, isn't it? That if you start allowing the editing of the human genome, that this is going to actually... What he's saying effectively is, here we go, designer babies.
Yeah, I mean, this is a question of bioethics. You know, what should and shouldn't we be doing and tampering with as humans is something that we've not had a control on, well, forever. Thankfully, it goes a bit broader than what I studied as an undergraduate, although I understand the process of what it is they're trying to do. These types of decisions need to be debated in Parliament with a free vote.
What he's saying is, hijacked by the free market, human gene editing will lead to greater social inequality, heading where the money is, which is this designer baby idea.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised, because ultimately what you end up doing is paying for your ability to avoid disease or prevent disease in the first place, as well as designer babies and everything else. And actually none of that should be driven by financial means. So I agree with that.
But we're heading that way anyway now, Martin. And well, it's in the United States this has happened, by the way.
Well, I mean, I totally agree that we've got to have a bioethics discussion about this. Some things are acceptable, some things aren't. I would make the point that we've constantly modified our own biology. That's been part of what being human's about. So we're not against it in principle.
Martin, yes, but it's very different modifying your own biology and changing your genes, isn't it? Adding a different arm on you or a leg on you or what?
Well, the problem is how much power should parents, governments have over their children? And should money be involved?
What do you think, Darren? How much power should they have over an embryo?
My sense is that the institutions shouldn't have a role, especially the market shouldn't have a role in these types of decisions. I mean, you know, the only thing I think that could be mildly acceptable is if you get to a position where you can prevent disease or those types of issues, but we shouldn't be getting into the realm of, you know, I want my kid to be a boy with blonde hair and blue eyes, therefore can you make it happen?
Yeah, sounds a bit Nazified. Now for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to our guest, Labour MP for Bristol North West, that's Darren Jones. Join us as we do our best to keep ahead of the curve after the news.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.